David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. David, what's new?
Well, Rob, I've got three cool stories for you, like I always do. We're going to talk about how much energy you're wasting by drinking bottled water, what your spit says about you, and finally, how rotten egg gas may be the new Viagra.
So wasting energy with bottled water, is that because of the plastic bottles, the transportation costs, or what?
Well, Rob, it's everything. I mean, like you said, it's the plastic. It's also the labeling, the filling the bottles, even sealing the bottles. And as you said, transporting the bottles, cooling the bottles before they are consumed. All this stuff seems like it would waste a lot of energy, but nobody's really quantified it before.
And we're comparing it to what?
Well, we're comparing it to just drinking tap water, you know, filling a glass out of your sink.
And the cost of transporting that to your tap or in cleaning it, make sure that what comes from the environment is clean enough to drink.
Right. There are clearly energy costs associated with drinking tap water as well. But there still is a big difference between the energy cost of drinking tap water versus drinking bottled water. And that's what the study is all about.
I suppose it's sort of like personal transportation versus public transportation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like, you know, say, you know, driving your own car versus riding the bus. And in this analogy, riding the bus would be drinking tap water.
So how many people are out there driving their own car or extending the analogy perhaps way too far, drinking bottled water?
Well, actually, the numbers really surprised me. It turns out that in 2007, people consumed 200 billion liters of bottled water. And Americans were the biggest gulpers, as it were. 33 billion of those liters came from the United States.
Where the tap water is clean.
Where the tap water is clean, right.
So there's no argument there for, well, you've got to have bottled water because it's unsanitary water
right.
otherwise.
I mean, in most places, if not all places in the United States, the tap water is safe to drink. So there's no sort of health reason to drink bottled water in the U.S.
Concerns over fluorination or chlorination?
I guess so. But, you know, that's probably a story for another time.
Okay, so 200 billion liters of bottled water sold worldwide in 2007. The operative word then is sold. We're paying for the energy that's used. Even if bottled water ends up being more expensive than gasoline, what's the problem?
Well, the problem is, I mean, if you're using all of this energy, it's potentially bad for the environment. I mean, it costs oil or fossil fuel to produce this energy in the first place, and that means pumping carbon dioxide into the air, which is a greenhouse gas. Bad for climate change, obviously. So the idea is if you can choose between two things, tap and bottled water, and one is much worse for the environment than the other, you know, and this is a case that environmentalists have been making for a long time. They've been saying we consume so much bottled water and we don't need to. What's the environmental impact? And the cool thing about this study is it was really one of the first studies to try to quantify what this impact is. And actually, based on the data in this study, Rob, it turns out that for every bottle of water you drink, it might as well be a quarter full of oil for the amount of oil that's being consumed in order to produce all of this bottled water.
And multiplying that by 200 billion gives me?
Well, we're talking about 50 million barrels of oil a year. And just for point of comparison, that's the same amount of oil used in the entire U.S. over 2 days. All the cars we drive, all the factories, all the lights we turn on, everything. So it's a really big chunk of the oil that's consumed.
Just from bottled water?
Just from bottled water.
Are environmentalists happy that people are recycling at least the bottles that they drink from?
Well, one of the authors of the study says recycling actually doesn't pay back a lot of these costs because when bottles are recycled, they end up as things like carpet or clothing or even toys. Most of the time, they're not turned back into bottles for bottled water. So, I mean, we're doing a good thing by recycling, but we're not necessarily offsetting these energy costs.
Okay. So which do you want to talk about next? What your spit says about you or the potential substitute for Viagra?
Well, I mean, while we're on the subject of liquids, we might as well talk about spit, right?
Okay.
And it has to do with all of these microbes that live all over our body. You know, we have tons of bacteria that live in our stomach and on our skin and on our tongue and everywhere.
I understand they outnumber our cells like 9 or 10 to 1.
That sounds about right. But what's interesting about these microbes is they don't just sit there. A lot of them actually help us out. The microbes in our gut help us digest food. And actually, recent studies show that if you have an imbalance of these gut microbes, it can actually contribute to obesity. And recently, scientists have been really interested in how all these microbes that live symbiotically with us contribute to our health or contribute to our diseases. But this study is not so much about disease. It's about what do our microbes say about who we are and where we live.
I remember there was a study about the bacteria in the gut being able to say something about where we lived.
Right. There was a recent science story that showed that a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori actually shed some light on human migrations in the Pacific. And this study actually started out by a team that also wanted to use bacteria to trace human migrations. But, you know, getting bacteria from the stomach is not easy. It actually requires a biopsy, which is not trivial. So this group wondered, is there an easier way to figure out, you know, what sort of bacteria inhabit a person? Could we get it from a cheek swab or even from spit? And so what they did was they went to about a dozen places all over the world, and they had 10 volunteers at each place basically give a spit sample. And they took these samples back to the lab, and they did a bunch of genetic testing on them. And they found in all these samples over 100 different species of bacteria, which is kind of gross when you think about it. But what was really interesting was that a lot of these bacteria had never been seen before. In fact, 39 of them had never been seen in the mouth before, and 64 of them had just never been seen anywhere before. So there was all these new species living in our mouth that we didn't even know about.
So with that data, did they find any correlation between the spit and the microbes living in the spit with the places that the spit came from, other than the mouth?
Oh, right. Well, yes and no. It turns out that there were some geographically interesting data. One thing was that people from California and the Congo had the greatest variety of bacteria in their spit, whereas people from the Republic of Georgia and Turkey had the least amount of variety. But beyond that, the researchers really expected to see some correlations. Like most people from California, they expected to see the same types of bacteria versus people maybe from sub-Saharan Africa would have their own species of bacteria. But what they found is there really isn't a link. Somebody from California may have a very similar population as somebody from Africa, and two people that live right next to each other in California may have very different populations of bacteria in their mouth. So there just doesn't seem to be this geographical correlation that researchers have seen with some other body microbes.
Do you suppose that might be because of international travel and, you know, the propensity of people to trade a little spit when they kiss?
Could be. Could also be diet. You know, different people, you know, you could be a meat eater and live right next to a vegetarian in San Francisco, and that could really make a dramatic effect on the type of bacteria in your mouth. So that kind of thing is going to need further research because the team really didn't look at these cultural factors.
What did they account for?
Well, they did account for other things like age and gender and rainfall and other factors. But, you know, diet's a biggie. And so clearly going forward, researchers will want to take that into account.
Okay. So finally, rotten egg gas. This is hydrogen sulfide?
Yeah.
As a substitute for Viagra?
Well, Rob, Viagra actually works by its own gas. It's gas called nitric oxide. And this is something that helps relax the blood vessels in the penis, and that leads to erection. But Viagra doesn't work for everybody. And this team was wondering, you know, is there anything else that may have a similar effect, but via a different mechanism?
And hydrogen sulfide.
And they turned to rotten eggs. And the reason they turned to rotten eggs, and it wasn't actually rotten eggs, but as you say, hydrogen sulfide, which is what we smell when we smell rotten eggs, is they saw some interesting preliminary data in penile tissue that was actually recovered from 8 sex change operations.
Why did the researchers look at hydrogen sulfide in the first place?
Well, actually, you know, hydrogen sulfide seems to play important roles in other parts of the body. It's a neurotransmitter, which means it can facilitate this crosstalk between neurons. But it's also been shown to regulate hormones and other things in the body. So even though actually hydrogen sulfide is toxic at high concentrations, in small amounts, it seems to be very important for our day-to-day functioning. So there was already some physiological basis that hydrogen sulfide might be important. And so that's why they decided to look at hydrogen sulfide in this new study. And what they found was in this penile tissue, they found a couple of enzymes that the body uses to produce hydrogen sulfide. So that was the first hint that it actually might play a role in erections or at least something important with the penis. And beyond that, they did some lab studies and they added a compound that turns into hydrogen sulfide to this penile tissue, and they saw a relaxation in the blood vessels. And this relaxation of blood vessels is what causes the penis to get erect in the first place. But they took it a step further, and they actually injected this compound, which turns into hydrogen sulfide, into the penises of anesthetized rats. And what they found is that the more of this compound they added, the stronger the erection.
So that delivery method doesn't seem particularly appropriate for people. Are they looking now for a pill or something like that that would get this compound into the right spot?
Well, that's the idea, that you would want a pill maybe that contained this hydrogen sulfide precursor that once ingested would actually turn into hydrogen sulfide in the appropriate place in the body and have the appropriate effect. But this whole talk of drug discovery is a long way off. As one expert points out, the concentrations of hydrogen sulfide they use in the study would actually be toxic to humans. And so they have to really find a way to make this work without side effects.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. What else are you looking into in Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about how undesirable evolution can be reversed in fish. And the first discovery of binary black holes, and these are black holes that exist right next to each other. Now, we found a lot of black holes by themselves, but this is the first black hole pair that's been found. So that's pretty cool. And then on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're continuing to follow Obama's budget and what it means for science. There's also an item about the U.S.'s race to the moon with China. Is there really a race after all? And you can read up on that on the policy blog.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link for the latest science policy news on the Science Insider blog at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.